They were told they were free. But freedom did not come with land, money, or protection. It came with rules. It came with hunger. It came with the same eyes watching, the same hands holding power. Across the Caribbean in the 1800s, life after slavery was not a clean break. It was pressure without chains. Survival became a daily negotiation. Who you could trust, how you spoke, where you worked, who you married, what you cooked, what you believed. Colonial systems did not disappear. They adapted. They learned new ways to control bodies, labor, and movement. And into that space, something unexpected began to form. Not a nation, not a flag, an identity, built quietly, in yards and kitchens, in churches and markets, in shared struggle and forced division. Piece by piece, people shaped ways of living that the empire did not design and could not fully stop. This is the story of how Caribbean identity was born, not from pride, but from survival. Chapter 1. After emancipation, nothing was free. Emancipation arrived with ceremony and paperwork. It arrived with speeches written elsewhere and laws enforced from above. Across the Caribbean in the 1800s, slavery was declared over. The chains were removed. The plantations stayed. Formerly enslaved people woke up the next morning in the same places, under the same overseers, on land they did not own. Freedom existed in law, but not in daily life. Survival did not pause to celebrate. Colonial authorities understood the danger of sudden freedom. They feared land ownership. They feared independence of movement. Most of all, they feared people deciding their own worth. So freedom was reshaped before it could be used. New labor systems replaced old ones. Contracts appeared. Wages were offered, then manipulated. Housing remained tied to work. Police and courts enforced order with the same force they had used before, now justified by law instead of ownership. The language changed. The pressure did not. People were told they were workers now, not property. But workers without land could not refuse work. Workers without savings could not leave. Workers without legal protection could be punished for survival itself. Families had to be rebuilt under this weight. Slavery had fractured kinship. Parents sold away from children, partners separated by force. After emancipation, people searched for one another. They formed households where blood ties were missing. Community became a necessity, not a preference. Marriage took on new meaning. It was no longer just personal. It was protective. It offered stability in a system designed to keep people unsettled. Women carried much of this burden. They managed households, gardens, informal trade, and childcare, while also working for wages. Survival depended on flexibility. Land was the central struggle. Freed people wanted small plots to grow food and claim autonomy. Colonial governments restricted access. Prices were inflated. Legal barriers were erected. Where land was obtained, it was often marginal and far from markets. Still, people planted. Provision grounds fed families when wages could not. These gardens were more than food sources. They were quiet acts of resistance. Growing yam, cassava, plantain, and other staples meant less dependence on plantation stores. Cooking traditional foods preserved memory when formal history erased it. What people ate became who they were. Language also shifted under pressure. African languages had been suppressed during slavery, but fragments survived. European languages dominated administration and law, but they were bent in daily speech. Words were shortened, meanings shifted, grammar adapted. New ways of speaking emerged that allowed communication across imposed divisions. These speech forms were practical. They carried warning, humor, care, and defiance. They were spoken in yards, fields, markets, and homes. They were not written down. They were not approved. They were necessary. Religion became another site of survival. Mission churches spread across the islands, often tied to colonial authority. At the same time, African spiritual practices endured beneath the surface. People blended belief systems in ways that made sense to their lives. Faith became less about doctrine and more about endurance. Churches also became social centers. They offered structure where the state offered punishment. They hosted gatherings, mutual aid, and shared discipline. Even when aligned with colonial values, they provided space for collective identity to grow. Colonial officials watched all of this closely. They measured productivity. They tracked movement. They recorded births and deaths. They passed laws controlling vagrancy and assembly. Freedom was allowed only when it did not disrupt order. Violence remained present, though often disguised as discipline. whipping gave way to imprisonment. Physical punishment was replaced by fines and forced labor. The body was still controlled, just through different tools. Despite this, people adapted. They learned which rules could be bent and which could not. They learned how to disappear in plain sight. They created informal economies through selling goods, repairing tools, and offering services. These networks sustained communities beyond the plantation gate. Children grew up in this in-between world. They were born free but raised under restriction. They learned early how to navigate authority. Education was limited and often designed to produce obedience. Still, knowledge passed through storytelling, observation, and practice. Memory mattered. Elders told stories of Africa, of slavery, of survival. These were not romantic tales. They were warnings and lessons. They taught caution, resilience, and pride without arrogance. Identity formed through what was remembered and what was deliberately forgotten. Colonial society attempted to categorize everyone. Labels were assigned and enforced. These categories shaped access to work, housing, and justice. They also shaped how people saw themselves and each other. Division was a strategy, not an accident. Yet even within these constraints, shared experience created common ground. Hunger felt the same across islands. Surveillance felt familiar. Loss was understood without explanation. People recognized themselves in one another, even when the system insisted they were different. This early post-emancipation period was not unified or heroic. It was fragile. It was marked by compromise and contradiction. People survived by cooperating one day and competing the next. Identity did not arrive fully formed. It emerged unevenly, shaped by necessity. No one called it Caribbean identity yet. There were no banners or declarations. What existed was practice, ways of speaking, ways of cooking, ways of gathering, ways of enduring. The empire expected gratitude. What it received was adaptation. Control remained, but it was no longer total. Something had shifted. The people were no longer property, and they were no longer pretending otherwise. Freedom had been declared. Survival had begun. And the struggle over who belonged to this region was just getting started. Chapter 2. Imported labor, manufactured division. After emancipation, plantation owners faced a problem they did not expect to solve by compromise. Freed people negotiated wages. They left abusive estates. They demanded time for their own crops. Production slowed. Profits fell. The response was not reform. It was replacement. Colonial governments across the Caribbean turned outward. They searched for labor that could be controlled more easily. Contracts replaced chains. Ships carried new workers into the same fields where slavery had just ended. Indentured laborers arrived from India, China, Madeira, and other regions. They came under tightly written agreements, fixed terms, restricted movement, punishments for breach. The language of the law framed this as opportunity. The reality was constraint. These workers did not arrive into empty space. They entered societies already strained by inequality and surveillance. Colonial authorities placed them deliberately. Housing was segregated. Wages were structured differently. Legal treatment was uneven by design. The goal was not harmony. It was leverage. African-descended workers were told they were unreliable and lazy. Indentured workers were described as temporary and foreign. Each group was warned about the other. Fear was cultivated carefully. Competition was encouraged quietly. Work schedules were staggered. Tasks were assigned along racial lines. Complaints were handled separately. Even religious practice and burial grounds were divided. Division was written into the landscape. Colonial officials documented everything. They counted bodies. They tracked productivity. They measured obedience. When conflict arose, it was framed as cultural incompatibility rather than structural pressure. The system blamed the people for the outcomes it engineered. Indentured families lived under constant oversight. Contracts governed marriage, movement, and residence. Breaking terms could mean prison or forced labor. Women faced particular vulnerability, subject to both labor demands and social control. Survival required caution. African-descended communities watched this unfold with mixed reaction. Some saw opportunity for relief from labor shortages. Others saw a new threat to already limited access to work and land. The system ensured that frustration flowed sideways instead of upward. Food became one of the few spaces where boundaries softened. Ingredients crossed lines even when people were discouraged from doing so. Cooking methods adapted, spices, staples, and techniques blended quietly. No announcements, no permission. Markets became contact zones. People traded goods and information. Language shifted again, absorbing new words and rhythms. Practical communication mattered more than purity. Survival demanded understanding. Religion followed a similar path. Officially separate, practically entangled, rituals adapted, beliefs overlapped, people borrowed what worked. Faith remained less about theology and more about making it through another season. Children born into these divided systems learned early how difference was enforced. They also learned how artificial it felt. Play ignored boundaries more easily than adults did. Curiosity crossed lines that law tried to fix in place. Colonial authority responded by tightening control. Laws regulated gatherings, curfews were enforced, policing increased. Any sign of solidarity was treated as threat. Identity was acceptable only when fragmented. Public narratives hardened. Newspapers and officials spoke of inherent differences. They described separation as natural order. The idea that division was manufactured was never acknowledged. Economic pressure intensified everything. Wages remained low across groups. Living costs rose. Access to land stayed restricted. Everyone felt the squeeze. Yet the system framed struggle as competition rather than shared exploitation. Some resistance surfaced, but it was cautious and local. Small work stoppages, quiet refusals, movement between estates. These actions rarely crossed imposed lines, not because solidarity was impossible, but because punishment was predictable. Despite this, shared experience continued to accumulate. The heat, the labor, the surveillance, the awareness that contracts and freedom were both tools of control. People did not need speeches to understand this. They lived it. Identity during this period was unstable. People held multiple positions at once, worker and outsider, neighbor and competitor, believer and skeptic. The system forced contradiction. Survival required it. Colonial governments believed they had solved the labor problem. Production stabilized, order appeared maintained. On paper, the model worked. What they did not account for was memory. People remembered how division had been introduced. They remembered who benefited. They remembered who enforced it. These memories did not always lead to unity, but they prevented full acceptance. Cultural practices continued to blend beneath official separation. Language grew more flexible. Food ways expanded. Social norms adjusted. None of this was celebrated. It simply happened. By the late 1800s, the Caribbean was no longer defined solely by emancipation. It was shaped by layered survival strategies. Freedom, contract, and control existed together. Identity formed under pressure from all sides. Colonial authorities mistook silence for consent. They mistook adaptation for loyalty. They mistook division for stability. But beneath the surface, people understood something crucial. The system had taught them to blame each other. And once that lesson was recognized, it could also be unlearned. The divisions were real, the consequences were real, but the belief that they were permanent was beginning to crack. Chapter 3: Becoming Caribbean Without Permission. By the turn of the early 1900s, something had shifted across the Caribbean. It did not arrive with a declaration. It was not announced by leaders or written into law. It formed quietly, shaped by pressure, repetition, and necessity. People had learned how to live inside systems never built for them. They had learned how to bend rules without breaking themselves. Over time, these shared practices became patterns, and those patterns became identity. Everyday life carried the evidence. In markets, people traded across lines meant to stay firm. A woman selling produce did not ask about contracts before making change. A buyer did not refuse food because of where the seller's ancestors came from. Survival made space where law refused to. Kitchens told the same story. Ingredients traveled, methods blended. Meals reflected more than tradition. They reflected adaptation. What mattered was what fed the household. Over time, taste itself became shared memory. Language continued to settle into something distinct. Not a single tongue, but a family of ways of speaking shaped by place and experience. These languages carried efficiency. They carried humor. They carried warning. They carried belonging. They were not meant for official spaces. They thrived in yards, streets, and workplaces. They allowed people to speak freely without permission. Identity lived in those sounds. Homes reflected change as well. Family structures adapted to economic reality. Women anchored households through informal labor, trade, and care. Men moved between estates, ports, and towns when work demanded it. Children learned flexibility early. Gender roles were not fixed ideals. They were responses to pressure. Who worked where? Who stayed? Who left? Who managed money? Who raised children? These decisions shaped social norms more than any imported model ever could. Religion followed a similar path. Official doctrine mattered less than practice. People attended churches while holding on to older beliefs. Rituals overlapped. Faith was shaped by what offered strength and continuity, not by strict allegiance. Colonial authority noticed these changes and grew uneasy. Officials saw customs spreading beyond control. They saw speech they could not fully understand. They saw gatherings that were not explicitly political, but felt dangerous anyway. Control tightened where possible. Surveillance increased. Laws against assembly were enforced selectively. Cultural expression was tolerated only when it appeared harmless or divided. But identity does not require approval. It requires repetition. Shared experience continued to do its work. Hurricanes did not discriminate. Crop failure did not respect contracts. Illness moved through communities without checking papers. In crisis, imposed divisions mattered less than proximity. People helped who they could, sometimes across lines, sometimes quietly, sometimes at risk. These moments did not erase conflict, but they added complexity. Identity formed in that complexity, not in purity. Memory played a central role. Stories passed down were no longer only about Africa or slavery or indenture. They were about life here, about surviving drought, about navigating estates, about moving between islands, about making do. These stories shaped how people understood themselves, not as isolated groups placed side by side, but as participants in a shared condition. Caribbean life was hard. Caribbean life required ingenuity. Caribbean life demanded endurance. Colonial categories began to lose explanatory power. They could describe contracts and color, but they could not explain behavior. They could not fully explain loyalty, conflict, or cooperation. The lived reality had outgrown the labels. Identity remained uneven. Not everyone felt it the same way. Some leaned into separation, others into blending. Many held both at once. Caribbean identity did not erase difference, it sat on top of it. What unified people was not ideology, it was recognition. Recognition of shared vulnerability. Recognition of shared adaptation. Recognition that survival here required similar skills regardless of origin. Knowing when to speak. Knowing when to stay quiet. Knowing how to read power. By the early 1900s, this way of being had substance. It showed in movement, in rhythm of work, in social expectations, in humor sharpened by hardship, in resilience without spectacle. Still, there was no official name for it. Colonial governments did not recognize it as identity. They recognized populations, labor pools, religious groups, nothing more. But people recognized each other. They knew who belonged, because belonging was practiced. It was not declared. It was earned through shared conditions and shared responses. This identity did not yet demand independence. It did not yet imagine nationhood. It existed before those concepts became widespread. It existed because people needed a way to understand themselves beyond what the empire offered. Caribbean identity was born without permission. It grew in spaces left unattended. It survived because it was useful. It did not promise liberation. It promised continuity. It allowed people to see themselves as part of something that made sense of their lives. Before flags, before anthems, before borders hardened into nations, there was already a people,